one thing that scholarship is beginning to recognise, perhaps a little bit belatedly, is just how extraordinarily important religion is to the war, and how incredibly important the First World War is to the history of religion in the 20th century and indeed beyond. I'm hoping in the course of my quick talk on this, very much a whistle stop tour, to convince you of these mutual significances. The war has profound impacts, subtle and multiple, and in many cases deeply complex. Dermot McCulloch, our very rightly esteemed professor of theology in Oxford, talks of the war as being an important moment in undermining the Constantinian connection between church and state, and I think he's largely right. So the first aspect of global religion, the war, that I would like to talk about is the impact of the war on the family, which I would describe very much functionally as the established churches. This includes, of course, the Church of England and the Church of Scotland, respectively, Episcopalian and Presbyterian. The Church of Wales, of course, is in the process of being disestablished when the war breaks out, but is still operating at least nominally as an established church whilst the war is going on. On the other side of the line, of course, the German evangelical churches, plural, are the products of the historical merger in the 19th century between the Reformed and Lutheran traditions in various parts of Germany, with slightly different flavours in each of the German states, but all of them are very much state churches, except, of course, in some areas where, for example, the Protestant churches are the minority church and the Catholic church is the more established one. And then, of course, the various state churches of the Orthodox family, overwhelming above all, of course, the Russian Orthodox, but also including the Serbian Orthodox, the Bulgarian Orthodox, and the slightly complicated case of the Greek Orthodox. The Greek Orthodox Church, of course, is an established Orthodox Church in Greece and not an established church in its much larger area of the Ottoman Empire. In this picture, I think you can say that pretty much all of these established churches support the war effort, although that doesn't necessarily mean they are as uncritically and jingoistically supportive of the war effort as some of the historiography tends to imply. So very often there is a great deal of overemphasis on the more belligerent sermons of some Anglican clergy, often ripped out of their immediate context. And most infamously, of course, the Lenten sermon of Arthur Winnington Ingram, the Bishop of London, which apparently, although rather misleadingly, because it is quoted out of context, seems to call for a war of extermination against Germany in 1915. It's worth noting, as Michael Snake pointed out last night, actually, on the radio, although I think I may have pointed it out to Michael, so who's open to question, that Winnington Ingram, and indeed all of the Anglican bishops in the House of Lords, voted against the bombing of German civilians in 1917, even on the grounds of retaliation for German bombing of British civilians. So in that sense, the Church of England does hold a line on just war behaviour in the way that war is fought, probably more strongly, in fact, in the First World War than it does in the Second, where George Bell's stance on this seems to be something more of an outlier within the Anglican Church. And all that George Bell is doing is actually, and George Bell had been the secretary to the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1917, is repeating the stance that all of the bishops of the Church of England had taken during the First World War. The German Evangelical Church, notoriously a number of its prominent theologians, particularly Alfred von Harnack, are cheerleaders of the German war effort and famously signatories of the Manifesto of German Theologians in 1914, claiming the justice of the German war effort. This, of course, is a manifesto that so horrifies the Swiss-German theologian Karl Barth as to make him completely reconsider the validity of liberal theology altogether. What the war does to established churches depends very much on what it does to the establishment. So, of course, in many respects, the Church of England and the Church of Scotland come through the war relatively securely because of the persistence of the political order to which they're aligned. This is much more problematic for the Russian Orthodox Church, which of course is thrown into crisis by the abdication of the Tsar in February 1917. Although it should be noted that for some, at least in the Orthodox Church, this is seen as a great moment of opportunity. That there'd always been an element within the Orthodox Church that had found its tight relationship and indeed control by the Tsarist monarchy somewhat oppressive. And there are certainly figures within the Orthodox Church who welcome the new opportunities involved in the post-February situation, hopes that are sadly dashed, of course, by the October Revolution and the establishment of a deeply anti-clerical Bolshevik regime, and then a terrible martyrdom that occurs actually during the early years of Bolshevism with the mass persecution of the church. For the German evangelical churches, the fall of the Kaiser and indeed of other German princely dynasties in 1918 represents something of a crisis in their own relationship with the state. It's probably fair to say that the predominant strand in the German evangelical churches is Lutheran, and the idea of their more or less unconditional service to the state. The result of this, of course, is with the establishment of the Weimar Republic, a real sense of disorientation. And indeed, most German evangelical clergy quite quickly come out rather publicly against the Weimar Republic. Ironically, in some respects, one could say that this crisis of relationship between church and state begins to bring back to the fore Calvinist traditions of resistance within the German church, or Reformed church traditions of resistance within the German church, which are initially directed very much towards the new Weimar Republic, but which also plays a role, and you can actually see in some cases continuities between one or two of the people who opposed the Weimar Republic in 1918 go on to be important in the German confessing church in resistance against Hitler. So in the sense that that element in the German evangelical church of resistance to the state begins with Weimar, continues with a minority, it should be said, of German Protestants during the Nazi period. The majority of German Protestants, clergy and lay alike, actually become quite strong supporters of the Nazi state. But there is an activist minority who stand out in resistance against the new regime. And then one could argue carries on further in German evangelical resistance against the communist regime after 1945 in the East. Perhaps the most extraordinary example of a crisis in church-state relationships actually is in the case of Greece, where in 1916 the Bishop of Athens publicly pronounces an anathema against the Greek Prime Minister Venizelos, the Bishop of Athens having come down on the side of what is effectively now becoming a kind of Greek civil war by the state on behalf of the Greek monarchy, and burns the Prime Minister in effigy in the centre of Athens, which I think is one of the most sort of remarkable moments in the religious history of the First World War. Not quite my absolute favourite, I'll come to that in a moment. So I think there is something of a crisis then of the kind that Dearmer identifies, which you can sort of identify with some of these established churches of various kinds. There are also crises in amongst the faiths which see themselves as being more universal in their reach, and here I'm thinking both of Islam and Roman Catholicism. In the case of Islam, the declaration at the behest of the Committee of Union Progress Young Turk regime by the Sheikh al-Islam, functionary really of the Ottoman state, of a fatwa against Britain, Russia and France, and sort of almost as an afterthought Serbia as well, declaring a jihad which will both protect the souls of Muslim soldiers fighting against these enemies, but also calling on the Muslim subjects of these empires to withdraw cooperation and even if possible rise up against their imperial masters, is one of the most dramatic moments in the religious history of the 20th century. It should also be said it is almost entirely ignored in most parts of these empires. Not absolutely entirely. There are small uprisings. There is a fair amount of evidence that there is a connection between the mutiny of the 5th Native Infantry in Singapore in 1915 and local Muslim dignitaries who are promoting this fatwa. There are connections between this and the Sanusi resistance in Libya, which had begun before the outbreak of the war. It begins with the Italian invasion in Libya in 1911, but which is intensified by these wartime conditions. and small indications of other resonances in places like Sudan, in parts of the Maghreb, and also some element of this, although it's primarily an anti-conscription uprising, in the massive uprising of the Muslim communities in Central Asia against Russian rule in 1916. The paranoias about a worldwide jihadist rebellion against empire, which are very well expressed in John Buchan's novel Greenmantle, turn out to be largely untrue. It is, in many ways, it becomes a kind of a fantasy of massive Muslim resistance during the war. What's interesting is that in the immediate post-war period, and something that I think has become significant down to this day, is the enormous amount of agitation in the Muslim world over the prospect or fear of the abolition of the Muslim, the Ottoman Caliphate. Now, in many respects, the role of the Ottoman Sultan as caliph had never been that significant and hadn't been widely acknowledged for most of the time when this claim has at least nominally been made in the Muslim world. There is an attempt to instrumentalise that claim in Ottoman politics in the late 19th century, but it's really only at the moment of likely abolition, or its perceived likely abolition, from 1918 onwards, that there is any real resonance in this claim, particularly, of course, in India, where the Caliphate movement becomes one of the key components in Indian unrest against British colonial rule and joins together. And in fact, Gandhi puts himself more or less at the head of the Caliphate movement in India, combining the Indian National Congress protests against the Rowlatt Acts with this pan-Islamic agitation. It doesn't really go anywhere, and the interesting thing is, of course, when the Caliphate is finally abolished by not the Western powers, but by Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, in his secularisation of Turkey in 1924, it happens almost without comment. So it's very much of its moment, the immediate post-war period. But the ghost of the Caliphate movement in South Asia is still with us today, and is one of the things that feeds into certain elements of Diabandi extreme militancy in South Asia. Catholicism similarly finds itself in a situation where it's caught between between the two sides. The Catholic community is split not exactly down the middle, but split profoundly by the biggest and most significant Catholic power, the Habsburg Empire, being on one side, and a series of countries which are of majority Catholic population being on the other. So France, Italy, but also Belgium and Portugal. Now, in the case of both France and Italy, the relations between church and state have been, to put it mildly, strained in the two decades preceding the First World War. There is the hope in both cases that the outbreak of war will lead to what the French, of course, refer to as the Union Sacrée, the coming together of clerical and anti-clerical components in society in a common cause. But actually, beneath the surface, the tensions never go too far away. Anti-clerical suspicion of the Catholic Church is still very much operating in these countries throughout the war. In the case of the Habsburg Empire, which the Vatican had tended to look to as an important and key counterbalance against the aggressive claims of the Italian state, the accession of Karl as emperor in 1916 sees a very definite political movement operating very largely through Catholic circles to try and negotiate some form of peace before it's too late. The writing is on the wall, really, for the Habsburg Empire, probably as early as the middle of 1915. And one could argue, if one was being incredibly cynical, that one reason why Benedict XV is so vocal in his calls for a negotiated peace, particularly, of course, his most famous call for this in August 1917, is the realisation if the war is not brought to an end relatively quickly, then this great Catholic state is going to collapse, as indeed, of course, it does in October 1918. That's not to say that there isn't, in the end, some degree of compensation for the Catholic Church in the emergence of several successor states which are themselves strongly Catholic. First of all, Poland in 1918, and then subsequently, of course, the establishment of the Irish Free State, which, in terms of the 1937 constitution, pretty much becomes a Catholic state by the end of the 1930s. Benedict XV, I think, is one of the most fascinating religious figures of the war. He's elected at the very start of the war. He's elected by an alliance of French and Habsburg cardinals. The French because they think he's a pro-French figure. The Habsburg cardinals because they think he's less pro-French than the alternative. And this actually causes him problems because amongst French Catholics, his robust stance, which is apparent as early as the 1st of November, where in his first papal encyclical, Ad Beatissimi, he talks about the war as a disgrace for Christian civilization, becomes clear that he isn't simply going to support the Entente side. Indeed, in many respects, there is a suggestion that Cardinal Mercier of Belgium becomes, for the Entente side, almost a kind of anti-pope, you know, the good Catholic opponent of Germany in his statements on the war, including his famous partial letter on patriotism and endurance, where he calls on the Belgian population to resist any attempt to collaborate, really, with the German regime, but to do so actually in a non-violent way. So Catholicism comes out of the war in some ways strengthened and in some ways weakened. And again, a complicated relationship with the events of the war. But one very important event that is of long-term significance to the Roman Catholic Church is what happens at Fatima in Portugal in 1917. And the series of apparitions at Fatima, primarily seen by a teenage girl, Lucia Santos, but also by her two young cousins, becomes a focal point for, broadly speaking, anti-war sentiment. Now, I don't want to be too reductionist about this, but it's quite striking that the first of these apparitions is seen by Lucia Santos shortly after the Pope has circulated another encyclical where he talks about dedicating the world to the Virgin Mary, and almost immediately she sees this apparition of Mary. There's a lot of reference in the Fatima apparitions to events in Russia, which are again very much on people's minds at this time in the aftermath of the February Revolution. But above all, there is a local Portuguese context. The war is not popular in Portugal, and the anti-clerical Portuguese government is dragged down in its unpopularity. So there is very much a sense that what's going on at Fatima, which is by October 1917 become something of a mass movement, is also a method of somewhat displaced anti-war sentiment in a society where the war is proving deeply divisive. Now, of course, the long-term significance of Fatima is very different in the degree to which it becomes embraced specifically by subsequent 20th century popes as very central to their particular reimaginings of Catholicism in the 20th century. But it's an immediate context and is very much a wartime phenomenon. Okay, there are many peculiar responses to war. Perhaps my absolute favourite, as I hinted at before, is the response of the Baha'i. The Baha'i, who at this point are a very small and marginalised and occasionally persecuted minority in the Levant, find themselves right on the front line in 1918 when the British invading armies are pushing north from Jerusalem towards Damascus. And the major centre of the Baha'i faith, the Baha, is in the area of Mount Carmel near Haifa. And when Allenby launches his forces into an offensive against the Turkish lines at the site of Megiddo, the Baha'i look upon this, as indeed do quite a number of evangelical figures, and they say, this is a place called Armageddon, because that's literally where it is. This is the origins of the time. This is the end times. This is the battle when all the peoples of the world are gathered together. And indeed, Allenby's expeditionary force does include troops from every continent. Indians, West Indians, you know, Franco-Armenians, there are Sipahi forces of the French army, there are Australians, there are New Zealanders. It does look a pretty good fit for this idea of the gathering of all the world's people. So the leader of the Baha'i looks at this and says, this is it, this is the battle of the end times. And then, and I admire him enormously for it, so what's the appropriate form of action? He says, well, there's a terrible famine going on in the immediate vicinity of Mount Carmel, partly due to the collapse of the grain trade in the Mediterranean as a result of the fighting. And he says, what we should do is we should get rid of all of our worldly goods. So all of the reserves of the Baha'i faith are used to buy grain for famine relief in the immediate vicinity. Now, as of course it turns out, this is not in fact Armageddon and the end of the world, but it is pleasing to report that the leader of the Baha'i was knighted by the British government for his humanitarian activity, so there was at least some earthly reward. Okay, well, I feel I should begin to move gradually sidling towards the issue of Baptists and the war. And I'm going to go there initially via the Mennonites, in a sense part of the wider Anabaptist family. The Mennonites have an extraordinarily tough war, just about everywhere, actually. So one of the most dramatic elements of the Mennonites' war experience is what happens in Russia. Under the Tsarist regime, the Mennonites had a place within the Russian war effort. Interestingly enough, and this doesn't necessarily correspond with the way that we tend to look at Tsarist society, the Mennonites were recognised as non-combatants. So what actually happens in the Tsarist army is the Mennonites are called up to serve as stretcher bearers and medical assistants, and are actually very much honoured for doing so amongst the Russian public. But with the breakdown of state authority in 1917, the areas where most Russian Mennonites live become the scene of what can only be called, you know, anarchic, almost Hobbesian war of all against all, including Bolsheviks, Ukrainian nationalists, various peasant militias, anarchists, etc. Extremely dangerous, extremely violent part of the world. Mennonite communities, prosperous, peaceable, become basically prey for everyone. They are readily targeted, their goods are looted, their men are killed, the women are raped. The response to this amongst some young men of the Mennonite communities is that they abandon their position as a historic peace church and begin to arm in self-defence, creating shutruken, as they call them. And this response becomes a crisis of conscience, not only amongst Mennonites in Russia, but amongst the wider Mennonite community, about whether it is ever justifiable to take up arms, even in the circumstances of effectively certain horror for your community. And this really continues to be a controversial issue in the Mennonite community to this day. And you know, if you talk to Mennonites about this, still something which, because of course the mainstream of the Mennonites reject this response and approach, although there is some degree of Christian sympathy for those who did this, or Christian charity towards those who did this in extremis. So that's the horrible situation of the Mennonites in Russia. It's better in North America, but it's still horrible in many respects. What happens in the United States is that with the introduction, with the American entry into the war and the introduction immediately of the Selective Service Act, there is a recognition in the Selective Service Act of the rights of historic peace churches to conscientiously object. But it is also drafted in such a way that there is still a requirement of national service, which again, for Mennonites and others, Amish, Dunkers, etc., can be incredibly problematic. There's also, of course, the situation in many of the areas where the Mennonites live that they become a focus of anti-German hostility at the outbreak of war. And there are cases throughout the Midwest, particularly in places like Kansas, where what will happen is that the local American Red Cross will go and request donations from Mennonite families. The Mennonite families, because of certain qualms about Red Cross activities, will refuse to donate, and then they will come under attack from basically lynch mobs. And so there are cases of tarring and feathering, there are cases of physical assault in general, there's cases of houses being burnt down. And this is a combination of a kind of community hostility towards the Mennonites as pacifists, but also ethnic hostility towards the Mennonites as perceived Germans. One result of this is that a significant number, not only of the Mennonites, but also Dunkers and other Anabaptist communities, end up crossing the border into Canada. Now, it might seem paradoxical, given that Canada had been at war for longer than the United States had been, But actually, the regime of the state towards these Anabaptist groups is much more liberal in Canada than it is in the US. I'm not sure why. I would like to look into this further. But actually, the Canadian government do recognise, and the Canadian government only really brings in conscription later in 1917 than the Americans do anyway. They also exempt Mennonites and other groups living in Western Canada. So there is a recognition of the legitimacy of their dissent against these kind of claims of the state. Okay, from the sort of wider sense of Baptist communities to Baptist more strictly defined. So, and I did do a certain amount of reading up on this before coming, so I'm hoping I don't get this too badly wrong. The formation of the Baptist World Alliance in 1905, I think, gives a global dimension to the Baptist story, which is further reinforced by other elements of internationalism, including the European Baptist Congress in 1908. There was, and it's part of what's being displayed here today, quite heavy Baptist involvement in the immediate run-up to the First World War in all sorts of interchurch activity, with Germany in particular. And again, and I think it's rather nicely mentioned in the first section of this, in August 1914, there is a planned Church Peace Congress of various Protestant denominations. It's planned to be held in Konstanz in southern Germany. I think it's on the 3rd and 4th of August in 1914. So you can't imagine more bizarre coincidence of dates than that. One result of this, of course, is that J.H. Rushbrook, one of the prominent figures in British Baptism, is actually in Germany in preparation for this event at the outbreak of the war. And ends up going through quite a torrid time. And again, some of the documentation concerning Rushbrook is on display here. The Baptist World Alliance, in numerical terms, is dominated by the American Baptist churches. The British Union is quite a large component of it and is actually a powerful initiator of this. But the American Baptists probably are the big battalions in terms of numbers. And it's worth remembering the Baptist World Alliance at this point incorporates the Southern Baptists, Southern Baptist Convention, as well as the Northern Baptists, although they only formally become a unified convention actually in 1907, after the formation of the World Alliance. It also has some level of involvement, although I'm not entirely clear on this, and I need to look into it further, from the American National Baptist Association, which is the Black Baptist Association in the United States. These three elements in the American Baptist world take rather different attitudes to the war up until 1917. If you were pushing a generalisation on this, you would probably say that the Northern Baptists edge towards an interventionist stance. It's quite striking, actually, that the American presidential candidate for the Republicans in 1916, Charles Hughes, so Woodrow Wilson's opponent in the 1916 election, is a very prominent figure in the Northern Baptist community and is associated with the slightly more pro-British, somewhat more pro-interventionist side associated with the Republicans during this period. The Southern Baptists, by contrast, are absolute Woodrow Wilson loyalists. And again, this comes out of that element of Southern Democrat support going back in many respects into the populist period. Very much opponents, actually, of American intervention in the war. And again, in that sense, I mean, think about the demography of this. The Southern Baptists are tend to be, if you like, some degree a slightly poorer and more backcountry part of the Southern community. So whereas the Southern elites often tend to be very Anglophile, the Southern Baptists tend to be a lot more suspicious of British intentions. And similarly, the American National Baptists, and along with most of the black churches, are also very suspicious about intervention on the grounds that they can't see that it's their business or any good will come of it. This largely changes with American entry into the war. The Southern Baptists go very quickly from being sceptical and isolationist to being supporters, most of them at any rate, not all of them, but most of them. With the Black Baptists, this is less the case, and the American, the Northern Baptists become real cheerleaders of the war effort. along with other groups. Now, again, it's often been suggested, and I think with some justice, that the scale of support for the war effort amongst American Christians usually corresponds with their degree of liberalism in theological terms. In other words, the people who are nearer the fundamentalist end of the spectrum tend to be more sceptical about the war than the liberals. And this is partly to do with the ways in which liberal Christianity is tied up with certain progressive ideas about social intervention. In the immediate post-war period, this global dimension of baptism comes back to the fore, in particular with the London Conference in 1920. And the emergence of what now we would call Baptist World Aid, which comes out of this immediate post-war crisis. The Baptists, along with large numbers of other religious groups, are very aware of the economic devastation that the war has created in much of Central and Eastern Europe. So although it's probably the Quakers who most of all take the lead on this issue, with the formation of the anti-blockade politics of 1918 and then what becomes the Famine Committee, other Christian groups get on board quite quickly, and I think the Baptists by 1920 are particularly concerned with this. I think there's a sort of double side to this, what happens in London in 1920, at least in my understanding, which is it's a combination both of very practical humanitarian relief but also the recognition of Europe as, in this post-war period, a mission field. So both in sort of supporting European Baptists, but also refocusing a certain amount of attention to what is seen as an evangelical opportunity. Interestingly, the Southern Baptists at the end of the war are really quite discontented with what had happened, because one of their concerns is that there'd been too much ecumenical activity. And that actually the Baptists as a whole had gone along with a kind of military camp ecumenicism and had lost some of their distinctiveness. So there's a very strong restatement actually amongst the Southern Baptists in the United States of their particularity. One of the things that I'm particularly interested in, because I think it's been a largely forgotten story, but one which I think needs to be brought to the fore a bit more, is the impact of the war on women's ministry. In all of the discussion of the impacts of the First World War, there's a story that almost never gets told, which is that the first ordained woman minister in Britain for centuries is Constance Coltman, a Congregationalist minister, who is ordained in 1917 in London. And this, I think, is related to the sense that the war had brought to the fore in various respects the significance and importance of female ministry. Now, some of it, if you wanted to be absolutely cynical, can be seen as, you know, dilution. You know, the absence of certain key male figures during wartime had sort of allowed women to come in as temporary wartime substitutes. But I think there's a bit more going on than that, and I think there's a recognition across a number of Christian denominations. So the Congregationalists seem to be out front, but the Baptists are not too far behind with the ordination of Violet Hedger in 1922. That there is a really important role for women's ministry ongoing. And if this is true in Britain, it's even more true in amongst the Northern Baptists, who are ordaining women from 1918 onwards. And indeed, Helen Montgomery becomes first president of the Northern Baptist Convention in 1921. And then holds the role again in 1922. So women's ministry comes to the fore in part as a product of these wartime circumstances. Finally, there's the issue of fundamentalism, which I've already mentioned a little bit. And again, although the fundamentalist modernist controversy is largely perceived as being a controversy, at least initially, amongst American Presbyterians, where it's become a really fierce dogfight institutionally, there is Baptist involvement from the very outset, and including famously the sermon by Harry Fosdick, sermon stroke pamphlet stroke call to arms, Shall the Fundamentalist Win, in 1921. And Fosdick is a Northern Baptist. Now, again, you know, one of the things that is at stake in the contest between modernism, liberalism in theology, and fundamentalism in North America is the sense that this is connected to the war. And just going on a few years further, when we get to the Scopes trial, one of the reasons that William Jennings Bryan, who's in fact a Presbyterian, is there fighting the case for fundamentalism is that Bryan had become convinced that the war had been caused by Darwinism. He reads Kellogg's account of the German high command, and which sort of claims that they're all social Darwinists. And for Bryan, who had of course resigned from Wilson's cabinet in 1915 over the Lusitania incident, and who had been a very strong opponent of American involvement in the First World War. The First World War is perceived as something that has been created by this movement away from fundamental biblical literalism, which Bryan sees as being effectively against this kind of militarism and state power. So I think if you put together a story which says that amongst the consequences of the First World War are the establishment of deep South American fundamentalism, the establishment of the idea of the caliphate in world Islam, the beginnings of the ordination of women in Protestant denominations, crises amongst both the Catholic Church leading towards a particular vision of Marian Christianity as expressed through Fatima, and new traditions of resistance within German Protestantism, you could make a reasonable case that the First World War is one of the most significant theological events of the last 300 years. And at that point, I think I should stop. There is one other Baptist story of the First World War, which I think again illustrates the global dimensions of this. This is a story of John Chilembwe in Nyasaland. And Chilembwe, who had been brought up in the context of Presbyterian mission work, but goes out at the turn of the century to be further educated in the United States by black American Baptists in Lynchburg, Virginia, and then returns to mission work in Nyasaland, contemporary Malawi, in the early 20th century. At the outbreak of war, Chilembwe preaches sermons talking about opposition to the conscription, effectively conscription, of innocent Africans in white man's wars. So he begins in August and September, when the first fighting occurs on the borders between Tanzania and Nyasaland, about saying that this is not our business, we should not be drawn into this. And then in January 1915 is the leader of an uprising against the local plantation managers, one of whom is a man called William Jervis Livingston, so he's of the David Livingston family. He leads an uprising against the Livingston estate, in part because Livingston, on the orders actually of his absentee boss, had been burning down Chilembwe's churches as being too militantly African and opposed to European rule. And Chilembwe kills several of the white plantation managers, including Livingstone, although he's very careful to spare the women and children of these white functionaries, and then preaches a militant sermon calling for a black uprising with Livingstone's decapitated head on a spike next to him as he preaches the sermon. It doesn't, again, resonate very widely, and Chilembwe is hunted down by British-commanded African troops and killed on the 3rd of February 1915. But I think in terms of Baptist responses to the First World War, this is one which probably won't be widely marked, and I don't think that they've ever picked up here. But I think it's nonetheless quite interesting, and probably in some ways goes back to the sort of very early militant roots of baptism as a fiery Old Testament faith in 17th century England. So I think it's a nice little throwback in that respect.